We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Continuing where we left off last week on election.
Where did we leave off last
week? I have no idea, but we're going to pretend that we're going to continue. So election endorsements. We got Maria here so we can cover the individual races.
Cover the individual races, yeah. Starting out with the King County Director of Elections, that one's a pretty easy one. Incumbent Cheryl Huff is a good choice for that position. Mark Green, her challenger, is, he's got some ideas about reforming the office, but there's no clear indication that he would be much of an improvement over Huff or that he understands the job as well as she does. For King County Council, District Number 6, it's a longtime incumbent Jane Haig versus challenger Richard Mitchell. And I have to tell you, between the two of those, Jane Haig it's time for her to go, past time for her to go. Jav and I were talking about this on the phone last night and making jokes about how that would be that the Jane Haig election night party would be kind of a fun one to go to for all the free booze. And I made the comment,
We can toast her departure.
Yes. I made the comment, since her DWI, her DUI arrest, it would probably be in her best interest to offer cab vouchers after her election party.
But since she worked very hard to cover up that DUI
arrest and was
verbally abusive to the cop who was involved, I think it might be high entertainment just to see her realize she was going to lose and get really soused and just watch the fireworks.
Yeah, it would. Richard Mitchell for that.
Yeah,
and
Mitchell actually, and I don't want to say too much about too many of the candidates because of
the
conflict of interest that I have. But Mitchell is very, very good. It's not just that Haig is bad, although she is, but Mitchell is also a very good candidate too.
Yeah, yeah. For King County District Number 8, incumbent Joe McDermott versus Diana Toledo, his challenger. I think when you look at these two, Toledo seems kind of thin. Her campaign seems kind of thin to me. McDermott's been pretty good. He supported the $20 car tab fee. Toledo, on the other hand, opposes it. That's the $20 car tab fee for Metro bus service. So I think in this case, I would support Joe McDermott for that position. For Port of Seattle Commissioner position number 2, Gail Tarleton versus Richard Pope, there isn't a whole lot of question here who you should vote for. I would go with Gail Tarleton.
Tarleton is very good.
She hasn't been bad.
Richard Pope is on his 12th local political campaign, none of which have been successful, and for that we may all be thankful.
Yes. And Port of Seattle Commissioner position number 5, you have incumbent Bill Bryant versus Dean Willard, who is a former T-Mobile vice president. Some folks are hesitant to vote for Willard for that reason. However, Bill Bryant has just been absolutely dreadful, I think Dean Willard is a good vote, a good protest vote against the sort of long-standing issues at the port, which Bill Bryant hasn't done anything to address.
Bryant is directly responsible for paying the CEO of the Port of Seattle nearly $400,000 a year, which really tells you a lot about how the port is run.
More than any other politician in the state of Washington.
That's like double any other politician in the state of Washington. So, yeah, it tells you a lot about the little fiefdom and the very corrupt little fiefdom that the Port of Seattle has become. And it's gotten worse rather than better under Bill Bryant, which is saying something because it was pretty bad before. Mm-hmm. So it's time for him to go.
Yeah. City council positions. This is one where a job will want to weigh in heavily. City council position number 1, Gene Godden versus Bobby Forsch. I think anybody who's been paying any attention to local Seattle politics realizes that it is Godden's time to go, that Bobby Forsch is a good replacement for Gene Godden. In fact, you could say that for the first time someone will actually be inhabiting that seat. Forsch has had experience in city government, but he's also very progressive. He supports a lot of the same policies that we support, and for that reason, we support Bobby Forsch for position number 1. City council position number 3, Bruce Harrell versus Brad Meekham. Harrell, I have to say this, every time I've ever been in a city council, every time I've ever seen a city council meeting, two people on the council impress me the least. One of them is Jean Godden. She's often there, but she's not there in her mind. She's, you know, thinking about other things, talking to people in the background, not paying attention.
The next party.
Bruce Harrell doesn't have that excuse of talking to other people. He comes late. He fidgets. He doesn't pay attention to what's going on. He asks stupid questions that show that he hasn't read the issue being discussed. He hasn't done his research. He often leaves early. He, I think, in my mind, is the last person you want sitting in any kind of a meeting, and therefore the last person you want on the city council. He's proved that he really doesn't have the patience to be in politics, because during his tenure on city council, he hasn't gotten very much done. The other city council members gave him the chairmanship of the City Light Committee because I think they were afraid to give him control of any other more important committee. And because, you know, the City Light Committee, you've got longtime personnel running City Light. So I guess they figured that Harrell couldn't do much to screw that up. However, in his tenure as head of City Light, as the head of the energy committee, City Light has had over 20% increase in electricity rates in the city of Seattle, and Harrell hasn't been able to explain why. So I think in this case, it is long past time to replace him. So we support Brad Meekham for that position. City Council position number 5, that's Tom Rasmussen versus Dale Pusey. I have not been impressed with Dale Pusey. So I am having a hard time giving him my vote. On the other hand, Tom Rasmussen, although he comes across as being a very intelligent person when you watch him in action in city council meetings, on the other hand, when it comes down to where he votes, he almost always votes with the majority in support of whatever initiative that will help the Downtown Business Association. And you can see that in the fact that he has raised more money in his race than any of the other city council candidates. So
much of it is corporate money.
Yeah. And so I would say if you want to register a protest vote, you can vote for Dale Pusey. He's not likely to win. Or you can just skip that race altogether and not vote for either one. For city council, position number 7, incumbent Tim Burgess, who has been the head of the public safety committee on council. He's a former cop, right, Jav?
Yes, that's correct.
He's a former cop. And he hasn't been very good on the issues that have come up in terms of the problems that are ongoing at the Seattle Police Department.
And he really, really, really wants to be mayor in 2013.
Yeah, and I think this is a good time to stop that drive for him to become mayor. And we support David Schreier against him. I think what really did it for me was Tim Burgess sponsoring last year's draconian anti panhandling bill. That was bad. Speaking of that, Seattle City Council position number 9, guess who voted for the anti-panhandling bill? That would be Sally Clark, the incumbent
and
position 9.
And most other things that Tim tells her to vote for.
Oh, yes. And she's another one, like Tom Rasmussen. She may seem intelligent when she does bother to ask questions. However, when push comes to shove, she votes for the downtown Seattle business interests without asking the really critical or important questions. And she hasn't done much either. Her main thing that she's been pushing to show her progressive credentials is that she's done work on affordable housing, which I tell you is really laughable. The work that she's done in housing has been to help support market rate housing, which in this city is way too expensive for anyone making median income or below to even afford. Therefore, I support her challenger, Diane Ferguson. We're urging you to vote for Diane Ferguson. And that has nothing to do with the fact that Jav is working on Diane Ferguson's campaign.
That's the full disclosure there.
And that's the full disclosure.
You notice there were kind of crickets from this side of the room. But I have in fact voted for Diane. Yep, I have.
Okay, good. And that moves
She'd
on.
She'd be very angry at me if I didn't.
That moves us on to the Seattle School Board. You've got a list of incumbents there in the Seattle School Board. I can't say anything really very good about any of them. The worst ones are Steve Sundquist and Peter Mayer. Sherry Carr hasn't been all that great either. And Harry and Martin Morris, who may occasionally try to do some good things hasn't really held the line for his positions. So we're urging you to vote for all of the challengers in those races. For district number one, Sharon Peasley. Peasley impresses me. She seems to not only know how the school board works, but she has some good ideas for what it should do for the future. Kate Martin is a concerned parent for district number two, and so I think you should support her. For district number three, Michelle Butow, she may come across with some too slick marketing talk, but she does also seem to understand what some of the big issues are and have good positions on them. And for district number six, Marty McLaren, a former teacher. It's always good to have at least one former teacher on the school board, somebody who knows how the schools operate from the inside and who was not a school administrator. She's coming from the right part of the spectrum when you're talking about a school insider. So we urge you to support Marty McLaren for district number six.
Yeah. Now that's kind of interesting because you mentioned not voting for any of the incumbents there, but with the exception of Joe McDermott on county council and Gail Tarleton on the Port of Seattle, you just went through the county council, the Port of Seattle, the city council, and the school board with those are the only two incumbents that you endorsed.
Yeah,
that's right. You a lot about the state of political leadership in this area.
It does. And it's not a bad thing to occasionally replace the folks who hold down seats for a long period of time, like, for example, Jane Haig. It's good to get new blood in there from time to time.
All right. So does that wrap up our endorsements?
Well, I don't know. Did you talk about the Senate joint resolutions last week?
Not in great detail. You probably want to talk. We had talked about having a difference of opinion on 6206. So
all right. 8026. Yeah. 8205 is fine. That's the one that would lessen the requirements, the residency requirements for folks who vote for the U.S. president and vice president, and that's fine for you to vote yes on. But 8026, to me, seems to be one of those things that it requires the state to set aside funds in their savings accounts and then puts limits on when they can spend those in good times. I see that as kind of backing into spending limits on state government, and I don't support that. To me, it seems really sneaky, and it looks to me like hidden spending cuts, and I don't like that. I think you should vote no on 8026. The state, I don't know how many times we've said it, governments are not individuals. They don't need to save for retirement. You don't need to put in mandated savings for your government, for government budgets.
Not to mention, if this isn't a rainy day, I don't know what would be.
Yeah. And when you try to mandate savings for city and state governments, you just run into problems. You just can't foresee what's going to happen down the line. So I urge you to vote no on Senate Joint Resolution 8026.
And we'll talk a little bit about why it's a downpour right now in terms of state government. But before we leave the endorsements, just to mention that all of those endorsements and the details on the election are at the Eat the State website at www.eatthestate.org. And they're also on the free print publication available now somewhere near you. I hope wherever you find free print publications.
Yeah.
All right. Let's move on. Governor Gregoire coming out this week talking about the state budget.
Yeah, this week, Governor Gregoire, she didn't release her version of the state budget, not yet. But what she basically did is she said, we've got a $2 billion hole, and here's what it would look like if we had to do an all-cuts budget. I've identified $4 billion of things that could be cut. Here's the $2 billion worth, or in this case, the $1.65 billion worth that I would choose to cut. The remainder, being $330 million of state spending that could be shoved just by one day into the next 2-year budget, you know, budget term, which I think is an accounting trick, and I don't like accounting tricks. And then she did this, I think, in order to try to scare people into talking about revenue increases. But if that were really the if that were really her motive, she would have then laid some possible revenue increases on the table, and she didn't do that.
And now this is the profile and non-courage from a politician who's already said she's not running for re-election, so she doesn't have to worry about what people think, and she's booting it off to the legislature, where all of the people in the Senate, State Senate, and House do have to worry about re-election, or at least most of them do. And so what she's doing is she's failing to lead. And this after she has already overseen over the past couple of years some really draconian cuts to the state budget and not putting any potential revenue increases on the table and not urging the state legislature to close tax loopholes or challenge Tim Iman's two-thirds requirement for revenue increases or the possibly for the closing of tax loopholes as well. So this is something that requires a lot of public advocacy and a certain amount of political courage, and we've seen neither of those so far out of Gregoire.
Yeah, yeah, and that's disappointing given that she's not running for governor again. This is her chance. This is really her chance to put out some controversial things and try to push to get them done, and she just hasn't done that. So what do her cuts involve if the legislature does sit down to talk about an all-cuts budget? She's proposing eliminating the Disability Lifeline medical program. She wants to eliminate the basic health plan. That's subsidies, not total coverage, but subsidies for health insurance coverage for some 35,000 low-income people in the state of Washington.
Down from 60,000 because it's already been cut by you know, quite a bit.
And this is after a judge recently ruled that the people who were summarily dumped off of the basic health plan, that a number of them should be reinstituted because the state didn't give them adequate warning and didn't clearly state the reasons why they were being kicked off. She wants to reduce maternity support services by 50%, services that cover 55,000 pregnant women who are at risk of unhealthy birth outcomes.
This is a
medical cost saver for the public and the state of Washington, that without this program, it's going to cost a lot more to provide care for these people.
And this is true of a lot of these, that mm-hmm. they're short-term budget savings, but long-term cost a lot more. Very penny-wise, pound-foolish.
Yeah, and other big, I mean, there are a number of those kinds of cuts in the budget, smaller than the ones I just mentioned, but she also makes cuts to not just these sort of safety net programs, but to the state levy equalization money for poor school districts. She wants to cut that by 50%.
Explain a little bit about what that does.
What that does, well, the levy equalization funds are for poorer school districts. So essentially what the state does is when you have a poor school district, say, for example, a rural school district that can't pass its school levy, or it does pass a school levy, but it doesn't provide nearly enough money to provide an adequate school environment for its students, the state steps in and provides what you might call matching funds, their levy equalization funds, to help those school districts provide an environment where their students can learn supposedly on a par with urban school districts. And that's money that she wants to cut by 50%. That's going to directly impact schools. That's really going to force those school districts to cut into what kind of programs and what kind of classes they offer their students. Students are going to feel that immediately. She wants to cut money to increase class sizes. She wants to reduce teacher bonuses, reduce school staffing, suspend the state work-study program for higher education students. And here's another one. She wants to reduce the general fund support for the state's six colleges and universities by 15%. Now, this is after 3 years of cutting higher education and forcing students to take double-digit increases in tuition. Now, here's the deal. Gregoire keeps saying we can't close tax loopholes because that would affect state jobs. Well, here's the deal.
What's the deal?
There are a lot of businesses in the state of Washington that want to hire and are trying to hire people. And they're having a hard time finding qualified college graduates to do that. And when you make education, college education, so expensive that only the wealthiest parents can send their kids to school, the kids who expect to graduate and get jobs doing fairly cushy things and not do things like accounting or IT work or become medical technicians, for example, the jobs that are going begging for good candidates. If you're not going to provide an affordable education for the lower and middle class students who will be able to staff those and think those are great jobs, then you're going to have a hard time creating jobs or providing the candidates for the jobs that are there in your state. And that's what's happening here in the state of Washington. We're making education so unaffordable that the jobs that are out there are going unfilled because there are not qualified candidates for them. But I do have to point out that in the state budget, the cuts over the last 3 years have come right down to the bone. There's not a whole lot that can be cut in the state budget. It's an $8 billion discretionary fund that the governor and the legislature can make cuts from, and they have to make $2 billion in cuts. That's 25% of that budget. And what does that budget cover? It covers education. It covers safety net programs. And it covers corrections, and there's not a whole lot else that can be cut from it. So it's time to start talking about raising revenues.
All right. Moving on, Occupy Seattle.
Yeah, major development this week in Occupy Seattle, the decision by the General Assembly earlier this week to move at nights to the Seattle Central Community College campus at Broadway and Pine, to that plaza there. They've been having an ongoing battle with the very schizophrenic city of Seattle and the Seattle Police Department over the past several weeks over overnight encampments at the Westlake Park. So the decision has been to continue a presence in Westlake Park during the day, but at night they will decamp, as it were, to SCCC. And in fact, they're going to have a moving up there today, and we'll talk about that when we get to events. Now, this move has met with the approval, in fact, the support of the American Federation of Teachers Union that represents SCCC faculty and teachers, but there's a real question as to how SCCC is going to respond to this, because that plaza at the corner of Broadway and Pine, unlike Westlake Park, is private property that belongs to the school district, or to the community college. And so the community college can make a decision as to whether they will allow folks to camp there or not. If you would like to see that encampment not be harassed in the way that we have seen some of the Occupy movement encampments harassed in different places around the country, you can contact SCC President Paul Kirkpatrick. His email is PKILLPATRICK at SCCD.CTC.EDU. We'll see how that goes. There's been a certain amount of tension around this decision and around the future of the Occupy Seattle encampment. Similar tensions have cropped up at some of the other Occupy encampments around the country. So I think this is probably a critical time, particularly as the weather turns and it takes ever more dedication to be staying out there overnight. It's important. And you can go, of course, to the Occupy Seattle website and see all the different things they need to keep people warm and fed and protected over the course of their encampment. So this is a good time for public support of the encampment and a critical time in terms of how SCCC will react.
All right, and on to the national Occupy Wall Street events.
Yeah, well, we saw several really unfortunate instances of police violence this week. The most notable of being, of course, the Occupy Oakland attack on Tuesday, in which Iraq veteran Scott Olson was critically injured, and it's going to be very interesting again, and in much of the country as the weather gets colder, what the future of this is going to be, whether people are going to hang in there, whether we see these increased efforts to crack down. This is very reminiscent of the Gandhi quote about first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they crack down, then you win. Well, we're in phase three of that right now, so we'll see where it goes, but it definitely is an important swing time, and it's been very interesting that you know, we've had a lot of political reaction to this movement. It's already changed the narrative very much in terms of corporate media talking about jobs and unemployment and the economy and the accountability of banks. There's a major day in this movement coming up on November 5th when people are being urged to move their money out of banks and into credit unions and other nonprofit financial institutions. And we'll see where it goes and what the impact is.
All right. Only a few minutes left, so...
Let's talk about the European debt deal.
Okay, let's jump to that.
Let's do that.
Yeah, the European debt deal. There's been a lot of talk about that. It was a three-pronged deal that the heads of European governments had to do when they sat down to talk this week. They had to do something about Greece. They had to do something to backstop other countries with high levels of debt like Spain and Italy. And they had to do something about European banks, which are heavily involved in the sovereign debt crisis. So first off, what did they decide to do about Greece? Well, the market has valued Greek debt at 40 cents on the dollar. So the market is telling us that Greek debt is only worth about 40% of what its actual levels are. But these European nations, they voted to make certain institutions take only a 50% cut on the value of that debt. Now, who is it who's going to take this cut? Well, not quote-unquote private investors, but it's the folks that own about 60% of the debt. In other words, Greek banks and institutions and, you know, like some hedge funds and some pension fund investors. Well, and it's only going to be voluntary if those folks agree to the deal. But so who are the private investors who don't have to take this deal? You might say, okay, private investors, that sounds kind of like mom and pop investors, right? Oh, no. It's the IMF, the European Central Bank, and big international banks who have already said they won't accept any cuts at all.
So they're getting 100%.
So they're still holding out for 100%. When you do that, when you force local institutions like Greek banks and pension fund investors and so forth to try to make them take half of what the face value of their investment is, and you're saying it's voluntary, my guess is that not too many people are going to volunteer for that, even though Greek debt currently is only trading at 40% of its value. I don't know that's going to help. And there's this question too.
Also net effect of that is that the much of the pain for that is going to be on the public in Greece.
Yes, and it's not going to be on the folks who it's not the public who approached the Greek government and said, "Hey, let me give you all this money, all these risky loans." You know, we know who did that, and those are not the folks who are going to be paying. There's also a question whether or not that is going to provide any debt relief for Greece, and I think the answer to that question is not very darn much.
But at the same time, there's also a tremendous sacrifice of political sovereignty that's part of this deal as well.
And then of course there was the agreement for what was supposed to help other countries, the $440 billion euro fund, which is not enough money to support Spain and Italy. The European governments decided to put in $1.4 trillion in funding into that. Really, it needs to be about $3 trillion. And there's no good notion of who's going to provide that money. European nations who have debts can't provide it. So they decided, let's create a special purpose vehicle and try to attract other investors to put money into it. It's not clear what the collateral for that's going to be.
So the actual bankers who helped create this crisis in the first place, they're not going to put any money.
No, I don't think so. They're trying to get other governments around the world to do it, and I really doubt that's going to happen. And then they tried to force banks to raise their cash reserves, but again, they chose a 9% cash reserve level for banks, and that's way below what needs to be there. So I'm not seeing this as a very good deal at all.
Talking, as we do every week, with John Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
It is out. It is in print. You can find it and actually hold it in your hands at places where you find free publications around the world, basically, you know, with Occupy Seattle coverage, the endorsements for the November 8th election and so forth. You can also find all that online at www.eatthestate.org.